The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. And we're reading, continue to read, from the October 2021 edition of Smithsonian, and we have read all the major stories. Here's some of the shorter ones. Under Institutional Knowledge, Lonnie G. Bunch III, Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. What it takes. A successful secretary must acknowledge the institution's failures as well as its successes and celebrate its capacity for change. In 1978, during graduate school, I headed down to the National Mall to talk to a man about a job at the National Air and Space Museum. I walked into the office of S. Dillon Ripley, knowing very little about the museum world, sporting casual jeans, an afro, and my favorite Army officer jacket with a Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band patch on the sleeve. Imagine my surprise when I walked out of that meeting with a job offer that would change the trajectory of my career. Decades later, I find myself thinking back to my predecessors and how their efforts, essential, transformative, and even flawed, shaped my understanding of the role. Ripley, the 8th secretary, oversaw the institution from 1964 to 1984, a period of rapid expansion at the institution and intense social change in the nation. He led the creation of new museums, research centers, outreach programs, and ventures, including Smithsonian Magazine, an effort close to his heart. He took chances on those who lacked the right experience on paper, me. He imagined an accessible Smithsonian, one that used its vast repository to serve the needs of the present. In his insistence on the Smithsonian's contemporary relevance, Ripley followed the model set over a century earlier by the Smithsonian's first secretary, Joseph Henry. An eminent scientist and inventor in the early 1800s, Henry believed in the Smithsonian's responsibility to the nation and its citizens. The worth and importance of the institution is to be estimated by what it sends forth to the world, he wrote. Henry was a visionary who enabled the vast and vital Smithsonian we know today. He was a scientific racist who believed in the biological inferiority of black people and barred abolitionists like Frederick Douglass from speaking at the institution. As the first historian in the role of secretary, I know that the past is too complex to lionize or excoriate my predecessors. Doing this job well means acknowledging the institution's successes and failures and celebrating its capacity for change. Only by recognizing the ways in which this institution and its leaders both lived up to and fell short of their own standards can we become the Smithsonian of Henry's and Ripley's highest aspirations, a place of accessibility, of innovation, of relevance, of richness and meaning. As we reflect on 175 years of history, our great strength is our willingness to engage fully with our past, build on our achievements, and evolve to meet the lofty goals we have set for ourselves. With that uplifting beginning, we go to the discussion page. Thank you for focusing on the resilience of the survivors. And these are letters from readers. Along for the ride. I'm not a truck guy, but I was completely captivated by Jeff McGregor's King of the Road in the September 2021 edition. What evocative writing. Almost makes me want to trade in my little hatchback, William Murray, Palatine, Illinois. Red, white, and blues. The blues are alive in places big and small in the U.S. and in many places around the world. This is from the article Blues in a Minor Key, September 2021. They are authentic American culture. Thanks for taking us back to the roots of the music. John Lear, Naperville, Illinois. Remembering September 11, thank you for the personal stories from 9/11. After 9/11, as the events of the day were unfolding, I was a teacher in Indiana, seemingly far removed from the locations of the tragedies. However, before the day was over, I received a call informing me my cousin was missing. He was a telephone technician in the North Tower and did not survive. We do what we can to perpetuate his memory. Thank you for focusing on the first responders and the resilience of the survivors. Glenda Ferguson of Paoli, Illinois, Indiana. We had the past two from Illinois, so I was on a run there. She's from Indiana. A Titanic Memorial. John Starr March's original headstone, When Time Stopped, in the September issue, bears no reference to his USC post duty. It was not until April 14, 1993, in the presence of his descendants and Postal Service officials, that we were unveiled as a supplemental stone adjacent to the original. Recording March's Sea Post connection. On October 9, 1993, our society presented a plaque commemorating the Titanic postal workers to the National Postal Museum. That's from Charles A. Haas of the Titanic International Society, Incorporated, which I didn't know there was such a thing. Interesting. Budding conflict. While I cannot comment on the moral justifications of the Turkish authorities, Seeds of Conflict in the September issue, the use of force to achieve their goals seems counterproductive and will only serve to diminish cooperation. The end result will certainly be detrimental to the practice of archaeology as a whole. Scientists who are citizens of other countries will think carefully before attempting to work in Turkey, Charles G. Eubanks of Brooklyn writes. And if you'd like to write Smithsonian, their email address is lettersed, LETTERSED, at si.edu. Under Prologue, the Art Section by Amy Crawford, Material Witness. For historians, quilts are much more than just decorative covers for a bed. In 1812, Catherine Paul moved from Greenwich, Massachusetts, with her husband William, their four sons, and William's widowed mother to the frontier town of Solon, S-O-L-O-N, in what would become the state of Maine. There, Catherine sewed this quilt, embroidering it with images of family members and the tower of the town meeting house. It's part of a new show opening this month at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston of 58 quilts and bed covers spanning 400 years of U.S. history, including masterpieces by African-American artisans in the rural South, tributes to Civil War soldiers and the Transcontinental Railroad, and modern works that push boundaries both aesthetic and political. Often patched together from myriad scraps of fabrics, quilts have long offered an easy metaphor for the diversity of a sprawling nation. But curator Jennifer Swope argues they can tell plenty of other stories about culture, community, and the power of remembrance. Quilts, she says, bear witness. Under Prologue, National Treasure, Key to a Lost Language by Jack Herrera. How an 1,800-year-old statuette illuminates an endangered Latin American culture. In 1902, an indigenous man, plowing a field near the Tuxtla Mountains in the state of Veracruz, Mexico, unearthed a green stone the size of a large mango, a piece of jadeite with carvings depicting a stout human figure with a shamanic bird's bill. Along its sides was a set of hieroglyphs, I believe it's pronounced. Before long, the Tuxtla statuette, as it became known, made its way to the United States and in 1903 to the Smithsonian. At first, archaeologists thought the statuette's markings were Mayan. Southern Mexico rests within the heart of the Mayan civilization, where Mayan dialects are still spoken today. But one observer felt unsure. Charles Pickering Bowich, a Boston businessman, philanthropist, and scholar of Mesoamerica who served on the faculty at Harvard's Peabody Museum, compared the hieroglyphs with a card catalog he had assembled of all the Mayan characters then available. "I cannot find any real likeness between the two kinds of glyphs," he wrote in 1907. Bowditch argued that the statuette carried an unknown indigenous language, one with no clear relative. In the 1960s, scholars hypothesized that it was Epi-Olmec, a late language of the Olmec people, the most ancient known Mesoamerican civilization, which predated the height of Mayan civilization by about 1,000 years. This hypothesis is still subject to debate. In 1993, John Justison and Terence Kaufman, both linguists, offered a possible solution to the mystery, aided by the handful of objects with the same script unearthed since Bowich's day. They put forward a translation, the first modern reading, they said, of Epi-Olmec. Further, Justison and Kaufman's translation of the glyphs seemed to reveal the statuette's age. Chemical dating was not helpful. Sampling the object's substrate would simply give the age of the stone, not of the carvings. The two scholars held that the writing in its entirety gives a year in Epi-Olmec, specifically AD 162, dating it to the middle period of Epi-Olmec society. Surviving examples of Epi-Olmec are exceedingly rare. Only 12 known objects bear its script. Given this paucity of evidence, some scholars argue that Justison and Kaufman can't claim to have translated the language until more artifacts come to light. Others even say that calling the script Epi-Olmec is premature. Yet Justison and Kaufman's translation has helped scholars decode other known objects that carry legible Epi-Olmec. In 2019, Kaufman and Justison persuasively argued that a poem on one artifact, which in their translation describes the transit of Venus, corresponds to past astronomical events. Fascinatingly, their reading displays strong similarities with the everyday languages of the Mix and Queen, I'm going to spell that, the Mix, M-I-X-E, and Zoquean, Z-O-Q-U-E-A-N, peoples of southern Mexico. If the translation is accurate, it suggests that the Epi-Olmecs spoke a form of Zoquean, a branch of the Mixoquean family. It also suggests that a descendant of the Epi-Olmec language is still spoken today. Accordingly, Tuxtla statuette was crucial in helping to elucidate a previously inscrutable ancient language and connecting modern indigenous cultures to a linguistic past once thought to be lost. It makes sense that Epi-Olmec would survive in modern languages. Jane Walsh, a Smithsonian anthropologist emerita, notes that the Olmecs are considered by many to be the mother culture of various subsequent Mesoamerican civilizations, from southern Mexico to Costa Rica. Indeed, anyone who has eaten a taco has enjoyed their legacy. The Olmecs were among the first to mix corn with lime water, a critical step in nixtamalization, the process of making tortillas. The Mexican government officially recognizes 68 indigenous languages within its borders, spoken by millions of people. Yet after surviving centuries of colonization and Spanish-speaking dominance, many of these languages, including Mix and Zoqueen, are critically endangered. Yasnaya Elena Aguar Gil, an indigenous AYUUIK writer and linguist from Mexico and a native Mix speaker, has written poignantly about the efforts to keep indigenous Mexican languages alive in what she calls a struggle for linguistic rights. Across Mexico, indigenous people are campaigning for public schools to teach indigenous languages. Today, Justison and Kaufman's account, the Texla statuette, is a keystone in that struggle. Imagine that a small statuette was one of only a few known objects where the Latin language survived. That artifact would become priceless for anyone studying the history of modern tongues descended from Latin, such as Spanish, Italian, and French. The Tuxla statue is a holdover of a sophisticated culture that endured conquest and assimilation, a heritage that indigenous people are fighting to keep alive. And now we go to Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. This is personally one of my favorite parts of the magazine. We don't always have time to read it, but today we do. Question: I've heard that gorillas often suffer from heart disease. What are the main risk factors? From William Mosteller of Fairfax, Virginia. Muscular vegetarian gorillas may seem less likely than humans to have cardiovascular disease, but it's the leading cause of death for captive apes, killing more than 40% of male gorillas in North American zoos. Based on studies of gut bacteria and other factors, researchers at zoos are rethinking the types and quantities of food given to great apes, including shifting from processed nutrient biscuits to the kinds of stems, shoots, and fruits wild gorillas eat. To avoid giving the gorillas anesthesia, which can place an extra burden on their hearts, Becky Malinsky, curator of primates at the Smithsonian's National Zoo, says her team has trained its gorillas to cooperate with heart ultrasounds and other data-gathering procedures. The veterinarians send the information they collect to the Great Heart Project, the Great Ape Heart Project, a collaborative program based at Zoo Atlanta. Up next, why did ancient Egyptians remove a corpse's brain and other organs before mummifying it? Asks Jenneth Larson of Mitchell, South Dakota. To keep the corpse nice for the next life, Egyptians believed the body would travel to the afterlife, says Alexander Nagel, a research associate at the National Museum of Natural History. But the only organ they deemed necessary for this journey was the heart, which they saw as the center of a person's soul and which they often left intact. After removing the other organs, Egyptians rubbed the corpse with a salt mixture to dry it out, another way to slow decay. They administered spices, herbs, perfumes, and oils to keep the body supple and combat foul odors. When it came to wrapping, more important individuals got more complex wraps. Amulets placed in the wrappings warded off evil on the journey to the beyond. Up next, are burping and acid reflux different for astronauts in space, since there's no right side up? That sounds interesting. And that's the question from Del Langer of Sarasota, Florida. Yes, in microgravity, air stays intermixed with food particles, says Jennifer Lavasseur, curator at the National Air and Space Museum. So burping in space is more likely to result in vomiting. Astronaut Jim Newman developed his own technique to reduce the likelihood of vomiting. He'd pushed off a wall to create a force that separated the food from the gases in his stomach, much the way gravity does. Next, do saltwater fish have a higher sodium content than freshwater fish? Asked David Majersik of West Hampton, Massachusetts. Yes, but they're not as salty as the oceans themselves. The gills of saltwater fish help pump out excess sodium, as well as other minerals like potassium and chloride. Studies suggest this process is controlled by different hormones. In freshwater fish, the process works in reverse. Their gills help pump salt in instead of out. Striped bass are particularly adept at maintaining an osmotic balance in both environments, says Matt Ogburn, senior scientist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. Although the bass hatch in freshwater, they migrate to saltwater before their first winter and return to the freshwater to spawn. Charleston, South Carolina, unforgettable hospitality. In Charleston, history and hospitality are our cultural heritage. They are as much a part of who we are as our award-winning accommodations, revered restaurants, and historic attractions. It's time to immerse yourself in our rich history. Breathe in the salt air and discover a place where you are always welcome. I think this is a advertisement. I'm getting desperate for content here. The Dewberry. The Dewberry is a luxury hotel offering old-world charm juxtaposed with a distinctive modern edge, located just across from Marion Square, the heart of the historic district, walking distance from iconic landmarks, shops, and restaurants. John Rutledge House Inn. Constructed in 1763, the building is both a National Historic Landmark and boutique inn. The hotel is an elegant testament to the past, featuring 19 luxurious rooms and suites, each unique in both size and architectural details. The Mills House, originally opened in 1853 and completely restored in 2014. The Mills House Wyndham Grand Hotel combines the charm of 19th century Charleston with contemporary luxury. Famous for its pink stucco facade, the Mills House is ideally located in the heart of the historic district. Planters Inn, Charleston's iconic historic hotel with spacious rooms and four-poster beds. Located adjacent to the historic Charleston City Market, the Planters Inn is home to the award-winning Peninsula Grill restaurant. That's got me hungry to visit our sister state to the south. Prologue, American Icon. For centuries, humans complained about the weather. In 1848, the Smithsonian Institution decided to do something about it. Weather conditions had been considered to be either God's will or explainable only by homespun nostrums like clear moon, frost soon, or by observing, say, the behavior of ants, which don't like rain. The Farmer's Almanac promised readers more accurate forecasts when it debuted in 1818. But even those predictions were determined by a secret formula, and still are. Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian, tried something new, crowdsourcing. The institution handed out weather monitoring equipment such as thermometers, barometers, and rain gauges to 150 volunteer observers across the country. Each day, their localized reports arrived by telegraph, and the Smithsonian generated a national weather map that it displayed on the National Mall. The map became a popular attraction. Tourists who viewed it, Henry noted, appear to be specially interested in knowing the condition of weather to which their friends at home are subjected to at the time. an amusing novelty, but no consolation for those pioneers crossing North America, the continent with some of the most violent weather on Earth. Only 2 years before, 42 members of the Donner Party perished in an early Sierra Nevada snowfall they had no way of foreseeing. In time, the number of Smithsonian volunteers grew to more than 600. Technology improved, and slowly auditors found ways of determining what rudimentary climate data collected about the skies over Denver might soon mean to the skies over Chicago and New York as weather moved east. Reports about temperature, humidity, wind, and cloud formations flooded in. Still, data didn't always reach the right place at the right time. For example, on the Great Lakes, 97 ships were lost in one four-day gale in 1869. In the year following that tragedy, President Ulysses S. Grant signed a resolution into law creating the Division of Telegrams and Reports for the benefit of commerce. The Smithsonian's Weather Observation Network was turned over to the Army, which began issuing official forecasts capable of seeing, if hazily, 24 hours ahead. The threat from sudden weather disasters diminished. Shipborne commerce vastly improved. Doing business in America increasingly meant knowing the weather ahead. The division would evolve into the National Weather Service, part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the Commerce Department. The first U.S. weather balloon took flight in 1909, improving the study of temperature, humidity, and air pressure. Another breakthrough came in the 1920s, when the balloons were equipped with radio transmitters and real-time observation of the stratosphere became possible. For the first time, researchers observed not only the width of a weather system, but also its height. During World War II, radar operators noticed patterns of interference on their screens aligned with heavy weather, and the science of radar meteorology took off and is still in use today. So confident were some of the mid-20th century weather mavens that they speculated the heavens could be manipulated by chemically altering the atmosphere. Bespoke weather, they believed, would bring rain to farmlands and snow to ski resorts. That quixotic dream didn't pan out, however, and Americans today are delighted to settle for the smartphone weather apps powered by the NWS computer and satellite data that give accurate information they can access daily. And that wraps up our reading for today. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.